Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
All right, welcome to today's episode of Firefighting Fridays. I'm Jeff Diedrich with Strategic Fire Training. Today's discussion, we have Chad Gruber, John Mateer, Jerry Knapp, and of course, Jeff Shoup. We're going to focus in on engine operations at large fires, concentrating on large caliber streams. Different applications, rate of flows, elevations, the ones that are easier to deploy, the ones that are maybe take a little more forethought in it. And of course, some experience-based lessons from our senior men. So let's get into it. Heavy streams. When an engine company thinks about heavy streams and where and when they're going to be applied, that can vary due to perspective, whether you're talking rural operations where there's a barn on fire, a suburban department that has fire on two floors of a house, or a busy metro big city fire department that may have like a mill going with fire on four floors of several thousand square feet at a time. So where do you think we should start with this, Jeff?
Start off with the definition of a master stream.
Okay.
All right. So according to some training manuals that we've used in the past, a master stream is generally something that flows 350 gallons a minute or greater. So, you know, when we get into heavy stream operations, it can be misleading at times where what we see now, and it's due to the technology, I think, that's helped us actually. And that is the hoses that are out there with the synthetic or polymer or impregnated tube linings allow greater flows at lower friction loss, as we all are aware of. It allows us to get water flowing at a greater volume. And then, like, for example, if we're going to talk about like a monitor, small mobile monitor, you know, some acronyms are like RAM, R-A-M, Rapid Attack Monitor. Manufacturers have their own title for them. Anyways, you can supply those with a single line of 2.5. And it's great for quick knockdown on one of those fires that you were talking about. It could be a rural fire or suburban fire, or even in inner city operations where you want to get a larger stream going than what a hand line would employ. And so that allows you to make a good hit, shut the thing down, reposition it, and go after it again. And so that's probably the smallest that we should see when we're talking about that 350 to 400 gallon minute range. Really, that should be on a large fire. That should be the minimum that we ever see flowing. So again, you were mentioning a department that has mill buildings and things like that. You know, Groover's got those wood framed 4- and 5-story apartment houses. In a building like that, where you have fire going on several floors, You know, you've got to get those heavy streams of larger flow because you want to employ their penetrating force and their extra volume to get in there and blast away and get to the seat of the fire. So understanding what the definition of a master stream is, what gallonages you're getting, and also the pressures that it requires to get those flows so they do the job for you. That's probably a lot of words out there, you know, that I'm putting out there, but, you know, I think we got to understand what is a master stream. The other thing is about understanding major fires and heavy stream operations. Look, the old adage, you know, that we'll surround this building with hand lines. If you have a fire building of that nature and you're going to surround this building with 1¾-inch lines or whatever, that's telling you right there, you're going in undergunned. You don't have enough water to do the job. You're just in a holding pattern in that fashion. So
I think if I can interrupt you, we've all heard or seen like the multiple hand line argument versus a larger single line flowing a lot more water. I think what we're a lot of people may get lost when thinking about that. Why doesn't that make sense? Is that it's the rate of application is what we're looking for. And if you have, you know, 500 gallons a minute divided up amongst five hand lines, I mean, it's the rate of application may be the same, but that water's not going in the same place at the same time. So that rate of application is really what we're looking for to reduce the fire. And so with that, combined with figuring out how do we reach the fire from that nozzle, the master stream is really the part that takes a little bit of planning and execution. How do we get that water to the seat of the fire most efficiently from a master stream? And that's where elevated platforms come in. Also portable deployment of master streams, whether it be a RAM device or some other type of ground monitor. I guess for me, I want to just poke that in that this is the argument. You know, the rate of application to one singular place is what matters.
Sure. Do you have anything you want to throw out there? Because I got something, but I'll wait.
I think Jeff's point is good. You know, we're good at stretched an inch, 3/4, 2-inch, getting inside. That's kind of our mindset. But you pull up when there's fire everywhere. Yeah. You know, it's time to change tactics a little bit and get that rate of application up high. I also think there's a little bit of we're concerned about pushing the fire back in the building, but if we kill a fire with the rate of flow that Jeff's talking about, we don't have to worry about pushing it. So yeah. Just the first step needs to be right, like you guys were saying.
I think it's worth talking too about the history. I mean, before the advent of our actual hose carts and having hose with nozzles, like the master stream was what the fire service was built on. We had a hand pump cart with some type of stream shaping device at the end of the pump. I mean, this is where we started. And do you think maybe back then those firefighters were more likely to move that apparatus around and to continually get advantage on the fire? I mean, now we use the hose, but when you see a ladder truck set up or a master stream get set up somewhere, typically it sits there for maybe too long. Once it makes its effect, it may stay there for 30 minutes to an hour to 2 days, who knows, but yeah. Rather than move it where it might continue to do what we want it to do. What did you have there, Jeff? I know you're.
I was going to throw something out there about volume and rate of application. And that is, and you guys touched on it. So when we have a large building, let's just say an old 4 or 5 story mill building, industrial building, warehouse, I don't care, a big building, with a tremendous fire load in it. And John, I know you have seen it. I know I have seen it, and probably everyone here has seen the fire in a large building, lots of fire, and you see an 1¾-inch line pulled. Yeah, it just defies logic how that happens. But it goes back to what Jeff and Jerry were saying earlier about we get into that mindset of the small, quick, easy to put in operation hand line. And I mean, I've had guys, you know, when I've questioned them, of course, it's like, why did you pull that size line? Well, I felt if I could get in there quick, I could get a lot of water on a fire. You're not, and the truth is, you're not getting a lot of water in a fire. you know, fires of that magnitude, your inch and three quarters shouldn't even be out of the bed. But we see them being stretched. The other thing is a great illustration, and this is what you get into when you have those old industrial complexes burning. And even some of these newer apartment complexes, like we said with Chad, you know, down in his area in Texas, Chris, they got all those new buildings going up, you know, they're all wood frame. So if they burn and they grab hold of that building on several floors and you're throwing water, and even in a range, I'm just guessing, say 500, 600 gallon minute streams. Have you ever seen a stream go across the sky and all of a sudden, boom, it's gone?
Sure.
It's because of thermal columns. And also that the heat is just taking that stream and blowing it apart, you know, disintegrating it before it even gets anywhere near the fire. Another problem that we create in that situation is when you see guys who are over pumping, and this is where that thing over pumping comes in again. When you over pump, what happens to your stream? It has a tendency, once it leaves the nozzle, it just wants to break apart into smaller streams. And that's why you got to tell people, no, back it down to, if you got a solid stream on a master stream device, then pump it at 80, like it should be pumped. Because once we get guys excited and that pump operator turns that throttle up, you got more mist and spray coming off the stream than what have water going to the fire. Yeah. And it's all like, hey, come on, let's put everything in our perspective right here.
Yeah. And what I haven't seen with master stream operations is nobody taking the time to say, hey, take off the 1 3/8 tip. Let's go bigger. We have the water supply.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge step that gets missed. And what you end up with, like you said, is an underpowered elevated stream that's just not going to make it. So when we position, we should also plan for the amount of water.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's knowing your system too. Again, if you're in an area like has newer water mains and things like that, you know, you should have an idea that, yeah, we got 2,000 gallons a minute to come out of our hydrants. Yeah, we got 3,000 gallon a minute at every intersection or main intersection because of the size of the piping and so forth. And if you're an older city or town, look at what Jerry's got to deal with. You've heard Jerry talk about his water system that's going to run out pretty soon if we get a big fire. And there's a lot of places like that. And the guys are not knowledgeable of that in those departments, or they don't think about it, one or the other. I don't know. So,
Jeff, I think that's important because, you know, there's all this talk about tapping a hydrant and putting 16 hoses on a hydrant. If you don't know what the hydrant flows, what the hell, you know, you can't make the water come out that's not there. So how about we broaden our scope a little bit if we're talking about master streams and just look a little bigger, you know? Right. Again, what Jeff was talking about is, I got a water district in my first dew area that if we apply master streams, runs out of water in 2 hours. It's just simple as that. The hydrant's broke.
You know? All you got to do is tap it.
So I think maybe one more vein of this to talk about is the master stream arena the place where automatic nozzles may in fact help an operation, where you don't have to worry about taking tip size off to match your capacity? Because if you have a 1,000 gallon per minute capable automatic nozzle, you should end up with a good reach, whether you're pumping 500 gallons a minute or 1,000 gallons a minute. Is that an argument to have that automatic at the end of that pipe, Jeff?
Yes, it is. I don't call it an argument.
Gotcha.
I call it knowing your tools and equipment.
Exactly.
Whether it's a master stream automatic nozzle or a hand line on an 1 3/4 automatic nozzle, when you put on a straight stream setting, you have a hollow tube of water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's the thing about a fog stream on a straight stream setting. It's microscopic droplets of water put in the shape of a tube. That's the whole thing about an automatic or fog nozzle, I should say. And where a solid stream, again, hand line or master stream, it doesn't matter. It's a solid tube. It's got that weight. It's got that force. It's got that momentum and that penetrating force. It goes back to our argument when we go out and work with departments and do training. that we're telling people to take as much water in with you as you can to kill it as quick as you can and do it as quickly as you can. Am I right?
Yeah.
So yeah,
I guess where I've seen the automatic nozzles, what I think is a good argument for them or is in that rural setting. They have them on the back of an engine that may go to those barn fires once or twice a year. And it's on a 1500 gallon or 2500 gallon, you know, tanker. And they want to be able to stretch that 3-inch way up the lane and put 750 gallons a minute on a barn. And they can do that without worrying about calculating for the tip size. And so when it comes to master streams, like we were saying in the beginning, it takes a lot of planning and knowing your systems and knowing your capabilities, what you're going to plan intending on using them for. It's a big thing.
Yeah.
So here's the stump the chump question on the automatic nozzle. When was that automatic nozzle last serviced and tested? We tested probably close to 50 or 60 automatic nozzles here in Rockland a couple of years ago. We had an 85% failure rate because they were not maintained. So with the automatics, especially with the ones that where the water flow, where the waterway has to be greased, every time it flows water, it takes the grease out, the lubricant. So there's the two dissimilar metals, you know, react and lock up. And so the theory behind the automatic nozzle, I think, is tremendous. If it's not maintained, like Jeff said, you don't know your tools and you haven't taken care of them, it ain't going to work the way you think it is. And what we saw was interesting. Not only they would not flow, we did hand lines. So it would flow like 70, 80, 90 gallons a minute. And as we increased the pressure, it would all of a sudden, those two metals would release. And all of a sudden, we're up to 300 gallons a minute or 250, whatever it was. And so if you're on a hand line, all of a sudden, you know, you're doing good. And all of a sudden, boink, you got double the nozzle reaction, and maybe you're not even staying there, or maybe you're not even upright anymore. So just a thought.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, great point. Did you guys determine if the water in your system had anything to do with the calcification of the spring and so forth? Because that was the big thing. Once you guys did that test, and I remember looking at results of, finding out what was happening, the calcification from the water could coat the spring.
Yeah, we didn't. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no,
we didn't get that far into it. We have pretty hard water around here, though, so I think that's definitely a factor for sure.
Yeah. You made a great point about the automatic nozzle being greased. I remember we had the white grease. And you hit it right in the head, man. So what? the water goes through the nozzle and the grease is gone in a couple minutes, you know?
You know, working in a place that doesn't have automatics and hearing about nozzle maintenance, I got to wonder if there's a lot of departments out there that are using those, not even maybe by their choice, but that's what they have to use. And there is no nozzle maintenance program, and there is no testing. Like,
I gotta believe that.
Yeah, put them at such a huge disadvantage, especially at a bread and butter fire, where you know you're trying to, you know, get between the fire and the people. But in a large caliber fire, you know, you're really trying to put some heavy water in. Maybe you're not even doing that.
I remember an old boss many, 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 many years ago talking about large fires and master streams, and he pulls out a solid tip. He says, this is what puts the fire out when you're talking a fire that magnitude. And as I've collected videos from and other stories from departments around the country, old departments, you know, and so forth, their history, their tradition, so many of them, they would use that solid bore anytime they went into master stream operations. Again, it's a selling feature. You know, somebody comes into your department and says, hey, you need this, you need that. And by the way, you don't have a fog stream or an automatic nozzle on your master stream. Well, you need that because you can blow the vapors away. What the hell? You're talking about a major fire. and you got to have stream reach. You have to have volume, shattering force, and penetration for that type of situation. So if you want to buy it as a tool to have when it's time calls for it, that's something different. But, you know.
So the history of master streams, at what point did we start putting them on top of ladders? Was that like the 20s, 30s when they started going up with the ladder truck technology? And then at what point did we figure out that the deck gun on top of an engine needs to be more mobile than the multiple piece ground monitor kit that I grew up with? I mean, that was a game changer for large fires, was having an engine company able to rapidly deploy a ground monitor.
Yeah. I think to start off answering your question about, you know, ladder pipes, if you take a look, actually there was a device before ladder pipes, and it was a water tower. And this was still back in the era of horse-drawn apparatus. You had water tower companies. In fact, I've got that video of Cleveland. I think it's 1904 or something like that. And it shows what they used to call firepower demonstration. And so, the fire department was taking a Saturday in the fall, I guess. I don't know what time of the year it was. But anyways, they would show the fire department to the public. And you'd have the ladder companies going by, but then here comes a water tower unit going by. And what it was a boom which had piping in it. And when they got to the scene of a major fire, and especially in a major building, they would take this boom up, and then the pipe could either extend or retract, but it was a solid bore. And that's what they did. They did not have ladder pipes on in service, I would say, till sometime later. And don't ask me when, because I don't know. But, you know, that was probably the advent of putting master streams on ladders, because you got to remember back then, too, aerial ladders were made of wood.
Right.
So you had to worry about, you know, any stress or something that might crack the beams or cause the ladder to collapse and things like that. So,
John, is Cleveland Fire still using the kit where they would hook it onto the ladder and then run the 3-inch up and connect it to it?
We still have one of our spares that we have to do that with, one or two, but all the other ones are integrated into the aerial device.
Okay. So sometimes things move slowly, you know, as far as.
A little bit. Those are real pain in the butt, especially in our weather, cold weather. Yeah. The ropes start breaking and stuff starts freezing. Yeah. Not a lot of fun.
Good times. Well, what about, I would say, what was the late 90s, maybe the 2000s, when the ground monitors really came into their own and started showing up everywhere? We've seen a lot of different technology with those. And at this point, they seem as light and as firefighter friendly as possible. Chad, you have some experience with a ground monitor that you could share where you think it made a difference, or?
Well, when I moved from the engine to the Quint in the last 3 months, it's when I really had to change. Shoop's laughing. It's about as funny as him saying, having to agree with an automatic nozzle. You could see the pain in his face when he said it. So, you know, I have this, the way I look at it, I have an engine that has defensive capabilities, you know, because I have a fog tip on the end of my Quint, and it can flow 1250. That's fine. But, you know, it's defensive fire if I'm having to use that right off the bat. So, you know, on my old engine, I had a deck gun, and I'd always use a deck gun for my quick hits. Where my crews had to change is now we don't have that quick hit capability when we get there. And it's only been 2 months, so we haven't had the fire where we needed to use it. So what I've done is I've just taken a ram and putting a ram in my back compartment so we can take that mobile hit quick. And I've had to teach the guys, hey, you know, one man can do this between you and the driver. Let's get it out quick. And that's now our deck gun. It's just a mobile deck gun is the way I tell them to look at it. And, you know, the Ram, you know, we've used others. We've used the other manufacturers. I think they're called Mercury, Blitzfire. And the Ram, just the guys seem to be able to get the Ram in place where they want the water a lot quicker, and you have more control of where that water goes. You know, I can get 300-400 gallons on something quickly. And then like I said, shut it down. And I think I have my medic doing the Ram when we get there, when we practice it. I'm going to have the medic do the Ram while they're outside and hit it. And then while they're doing that, we're pulling the lines to go in, you know, as soon as they're done with it. But you don't have
much water do you have on your apparatus?
I only have 500 gallons. So I've got 1 minute. And then, you know, if it's more than that, get a, you know, the way I have it set up now is one guy grabs the Ram, the other guy helps with the water supply off of the medic. And then, you know, if we still need more big water and we run out, well, we'll get the water connection and water supply and keep doing it until we need to. But yeah, I think, you know, I've had the one, my old engine had the deck gun that I could mount anywhere and take it off the top of the deck and put it on the tripod on the ground. And that just seemed like a pain in the butt. Plus those things are really heavy and trying to get it down.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. Huh? They were extremely heavy.
Extremely heavy. And I trying mean, to
75, 80 pounds on the top of an engine. You're trying.
Yeah, I'm just going to hang over and hand this to somebody. It never worked. So I do like the mobile monitors a little bit better. And of course, since I've been with you guys, you know, last week, John and I were using the Ram and teaching it. So it works a lot better, I've found.
Yeah, for sure.
Jerry, help us out here, Jerry, with getting firefighters to understand that we want to, when we pull up, that we need to get the water out of the water tank and onto the fire as quickly as possible. And we got to fight that mindset. I'm turning it over to you for that one.
Yeah, of saving the water, and you got to pace yourself, you know. Let's give that fire a good shot. I think Chad said something really important. You know, you got that, and you guys, John was mentioning that 500 gallons. If you can kick that fire in the butt with 500 gallons, it buys you some time, you know, with that tank water. Of course, obviously, if you don't give it a good enough knock, it's coming back really, really fast, and maybe that wasn't the right thing that day, but it's always a good shot. I think there's another option. You know, Chad talked about the Quint, and I had a very successful fire one night. We were short of manpower. This is a residential neighborhood. The houses were close, 2.5-story wood frames. The one house is like got fire from, you know, the shrubs through the attic. I mean, there's no house. There's just all fire. So the Quint pulls up, didn't drop a line from the hydrant. We had 300 gallons of water. I stretched 1¾ inches into the driveway of the house that was burning, used the cars as a heat shield, and it was hot. So I was glad to duck down. We dumped that 300 gallons of water on the exposure, and that bought us enough time. There was nothing left to save in the house. So that bought us enough time to get water through the aerial and knock the main body of fire down. But, you know, we talk about getting water on the fire right away, and that's important. Maybe one of the options we need to look at strategically is, do we protect the exposures first with the limited amount of water we've got? And then that, again, that buys us some time to put some serious water on the fire. So just options.
Yeah. I think you make the point, and if I could summarize, if you don't have the capability to stop the fire with the rate of application at your disposal, then go to exposures and take care of where the fire wants to go versus where the fire is, you know.
Exactly. It doesn't take a lot of water to protect the exposure. You know, you get that water running down the side of the building. Yeah, I think the other thing that's important is that there was this big years ago, water curtains, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the water curtain, the science tells us it's just not dense enough to get all of that radiant heat. So a lot of radiant heat makes it through the water curtain. And I always thought, I don't have any basis for this, but I always thought water curtains worked because enough water got on the exposure by accident, you know, and that's why it worked, you know. So
right.
Yeah.
I think William Clark talked about that, water curtains, and the I guess you call it the misreadings or misunderstandings about them. Yeah. so forth. Yeah, he talked about opacity of water and that it has none. So radiant heat is light energy. And so it just passes that heat right on through, like you said. The guys brought up last week, we were flowing the Rams and the 2.5s and so forth. So when we got into the scenario, we had that forward lay and we went into the deck gun with water from the tank. And you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember, I think Micah was timing, you know, from the time the deck gun's flowing to the time it ran out. It was about a minute. The 500-gallon water tank pumping at 80 PSI through an 1 3/8 tip, it just seemed to fall right in place. And that was the thing about the forward lay. So fire departments that, you know, when you turn the corner and you got that big ball of fire waiting down the street for you, and you're going to do a forward lay, okay, stop, get the hydrant. The firefighter on the hydrant, he loops it, waves the engine on, that engine pulls up and positions itself in a good position that it can apply that 500 gallons of water where it can possibly make a knock or possibly slow it down or something. All that time, that firefighter at the hydrant should be having that hydrant hooked up to that supply line. So within that minute of water, that pump operator is, we told those guys up there too, when we were running the scenarios, you better have your running shoes on. And they did a great job. You know, they're great. Those students were super, but the deck gun's flowing and you got to get that supply line broken in the intake then, and then make the call for water. So if you run out of water, okay, fine. But at least you got 500 gallons of water on the water on the fire. So, yeah.
Jeff, go ahead, John. Going along the lines of what you were saying, the only way that those things happen is with training, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't train, you know, as you're driving down the street, that's not the time to try and run that play, you know? Right. You should have practiced it before. You asked earlier, why do you guys take inch and three-quarter line to a big fire?
Train with.
A couple of reasons. One is they don't know any better. They're not even thinking about how to read the fire. It might be the boss's fault. He might have the same problem that guys on the back step have,
right?
Or whatever, you know. So it's a lot of things going into why they're not putting that big fire, the big water on the fire.
Right, right.
Very good. Quick, I know I'm going to be Captain Obvious here, but I think we need to say it because I didn't think we needed to say it last week. Never walk in front of a master stream.
You know, good point. You know, you get hurt when you do that. It's just, yeah, we had a...
We'll leave names out and cities out.
No. It was a mistake. It was a mistake made by a young firefighter. And we're flowing during the scenario. And for some reason, he stepped in front of it and got hit. So, folks, a master stream especially is unforgiving. You get in its way, it's gonna blow you out of its way. So, okay, move on.
Think about the force that's involved. 8 pounds a gallon. You got 200 gallons, well, 300 gallons a minute. It's like a ton of water a minute coming out of there, you know?
Yeah.
Well, along 160 gallons, which happened to be the one he walked in front of.
How much was it, Chet?
I think we were getting Ozar flow meter. We're going 460, 480.
Yeah. Yeah. We only had a minute of water, so we were right around 500. So maybe a little less than 500 a minute. God.
I mean, that's a lot of weight. And like in Chad's case, if he has these new lightweight buildings, you got to think about how much water weight you're adding to the building.
That's a good point, Jeff. You and I were talking about the Venadome yesterday, cubic feet of water. How much? What, 63 pounds? How long does it take to put a cubic foot of water into a building?
Well, see, that's the whole thing. When you have a lot of fire, in this case, the Venadome Hotel was an older building and built back in the late 1800s. But you take a building that's been altered, which it had been. That was another thing. Bearing walls been breached or removed for whatever, you know, alterations they were doing. And then you have a heavy body of fire working on the steel columns and things like that. Then you have the water weight added. And then you put a bunch of firemen in there after they knock the fires down and go in to overhaul it. And you got to slosh around in 6 or 8 inches of water that's angled, you know, deep. You know,
You know, when I think of that, and, you know, I think of, we've all been there in Portland, the Crystal Ballroom, that floated wooden floor. Mm-hmm. What if we were putting water on top of that?
Oh, see, that's the thing about company inspections, knowing the buildings. And if you get a heavy body of fire and you're resorting to master stream operations, Jerry, what'd you just say? A ton of water a minute goes through a, well, or is that, no, that's a 2.5, right?
Well, if it's 8 pounds a gallon, you're flinging 500 gallons, like John said, that's what, a ton of water, right?
Yeah.
2 tons.
A ton. It's two tons a minute. That's right. 4,000 pounds a minute. So, I mean, you know, how quick does a minute go on the fire ground?
Right. Right. And that's the other thing about positioning firefighters and equipment and apparatus.
Yeah, let's get into that. Like, it's part of the master stream planning and setup. You don't want to turn yourself or your apparatus into an exposure, either for the fire or from collapse.
Yeah. So. All right. So once again, how big is your building? Is it a long building? Is it a tall building? Is it a combination of both? Is there any windage? Because I remember when we were doing the MCTO series classes, that's Managing Company Tactical Operations, that came out of the National Fire Academy for teaching across the country. Three things that impact a fire, and that's temperature. I'm sorry.
Wind.
The wind. What the heck was the brain fart? But I know the wind had the most profound impact on temperature, wind, humidity had the most impact. It was a wind that had the most impact on firefighting. So if you have a building that the fire can be blown through, well, a lot of people who have written articles before talked about getting ahead of the fire, cutting it off. So,
yeah. And as far as being an exposure, just because you're a little further down the road, if it is a long building, if that front wall were to collapse and pull in, it could still get you far from the actual address that's on fire.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, as far as being an exposure to collapse, you can take the corner if you can. If not, 2.5 times the height of the building, you got to be away from it.
Yeah, you're right.
And that includes your water supply, you know, maybe the command post. I mean, you want to keep some of these things away from the building in case it falls down, right? So make sure we do the math on that. What's another common mistake we see here with master streams? Is roofing material sheds water, whether it's from a fire appliance or whether it's from a rain cloud. Master streams hitting a roof structure that's still intact, not doing us any good.
Right. It's burning underneath.
Captain Obvious, right?
Yeah.
Captain Obvious, but how many times we sit there and watch that for a half hour and they just keep hitting that?
I don't know why. Nothing to do.
Well, no changes to the fire. It seems to get bigger.
You know, we had that fire in Addison, our last big fire, and I was trying to remember how many apartments we lost, but it was a 5-story, you know, like Jeff said, one of those 5-story apartment buildings, and it had the tile roofs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, but it broke through to the point, you know, I could see it. I was driving in and I could see it from, you know, 25 miles away as I got on one of our overpasses. And I'm like, oh, this isn't going to be good. And they were sweating pipe in the attic and it ran the whole attic. But master streams wouldn't get to it because it hadn't broken through the roof yet.
Right.
And, you know, they tried to do it, you know, at the time we had, they took 2.5 to the top, but it just wasn't enough water. You know, I always wondered, well, what would happen if we'd have gotten rams in there in that attic and shot them up into the attic to put a knock on it, but you couldn't get to it from a master stream. You had to get it from underneath until that terracotta broke off and fell. And then you could get to it. And we left the master streams there for 2 days. Jeff?
So did you guys have any gables in that roof?
Hang on. I'm trying to think of
a gable like that.
Yeah, no, it was more of a...
They're all hips.
Mansard. Yeah, it almost would look like a mansard, but it wasn't a very lot.
Okay. See, yeah. Now that's something about positioning of apparatus and depending on, you know, access to the roof with your platforms.
And you know what?
That was a tactic that was taught years ago. And that was get the bucket up there with a couple of guys in it. If they can take out the gables, you get your master stream set right there. Start playing it in from there. If you have a mansard, well, once again, you need the tools to break through. If your mansard is made of tile or whatever, something like that, you need a sledgehammer to do that. But you break through those tiles, and then you have to break through the, what are they using, OSB underneath that or something like that? I don't know.
OSB. This one's weird. It has tile on top and on the side, and then it has the rubber lining. They've stopped putting roof material. You know, they just put a rubber skin over the top of the roof.
Yeah, membrane protection.
Yeah, and it just, all it does is gunk up your saws. But, you know, this was a, and to make matters worse, there's trees all around the building to where you couldn't even get the aerials. You know, you had to go up over trees before you could get it. And then by the time they did get up there, I think the heat was so much that, you know, how much water were we actually getting in there?
Well, that goes right back to the sides of the stream and its penetrating force with its reach.
Yeah, exactly.
So with that come again, I keep hitting planning, you know, and being prepared and practicing. But when you're dealing with master streams, you're into something that's beyond your bread and butter. So make sure that you're calling enough help to get there with you. Your standard first or second alarm probably is not going to be enough. You need to make sure that you've got not only units and people to help fight the fire, but then reserve units to help do relief, extensive overhaul, maybe, you know, checking downwind if it's a windy day for where the brands are going. I mean, it takes a lot more to get your head wrapped around a big fire because it's a big fire. It's multiple line fire, and those suck because there's multiple lines. You need to have a accountability for all of it. Not just right now, but an hour from now and then 2 days from now, that fire needs to be thought about. Where else can we go with the discussion as far as the streams and the placement and the application? We talked about how the apparatus has evolved and the different types of nozzle selections.
Here's the interesting thing about water supply at a major fire. So we go out, we hook a five inch line from the hydrant to the engine, and we can flow upwards of 1500 gallons a minute, you know, through different appliances and hand lines, different sizes and things like that. And again, in Chad's case, he's got these five story apartment buildings. They're wood frame. Here's one. And this thing is roaring to beat hell. Let's just give it three floors. Let's not even say the building's completely evolved, but three floors. That's going to tax your personnel to the limit right there. Because you cannot just say, we're going to put a line on the third floor, the fourth floor, the fifth floor. This is how we're going to do it. Yeah, it sounds good when we're talking like this or when you're in a classroom and you're talking about academics. In the real world, when you got smoke banking down to the second floor or filling the street with smoke because weather conditions, atmospheric conditions, things like that, it changes that, you know, pristine environment, you know, that we talk about in the classroom or the parking lot into like, how in the heck are we going to get guys in there? And we can't put guys in there like that and commit people above, you know, if the situation won't allow us. So now here we have this building that's rapidly deteriorating, and you've got other buildings built the same way on either side. Exposures, what do we call them, 2 and 4 or B and D. And maybe you got something on the seaside, even though you might not be by the ocean. We got to throw that joke out there. But anyways, you know, you've got to think about the water that's necessary for those buildings too. So you have to attack the fire. And Jeff, you brought it up about how long do we run a master stream, I think you said, you know, from one location. This is that whole thing about when we run out of stuff to burn here, then we might have to reposition that master stream to get a better angle of attack. If the fire gets into that exposure over on this side, you're going to have to put multiple hand lines in there quickly if you can, you know, start pulling the plaster or the ceilings or whatever to try to get to the fire there. Otherwise, that building is going to become a casualty also. And this is the whole thing about everybody being on the same page, everybody working under one command. None of this stuff where you run freelance into a building when you get there because you're all excited, your pants are wet, and you haven't even gotten there in the fire yet, right? You know what I'm talking about. This is where company concept comes in also, and that's accountability. So we have, let's just say the fire building, you're a five-story building, and we got fire in those three floors, and we're resorting to a master stream operation. We got two master streams, one at each corner going in, and now we have this building where the fire is getting into. And it's another wood frame building too. If I remember when you showed me around down there, that's what it looked like. They're all built together, but separate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Where do those people come from? You know, and that's why, again, you got to go and get an order where you're going to position yourself and become part of the overall plan. Lines in this floor, this floor, this floor. You have to have, you can't send a line by itself. You have to send firefighters with tools. One of the things I remember when I was taking all my tech courses and so forth, they were talking about administering to the fire ground. You know, you just get, you know, it doesn't look good when you're out in the third floor. Hey, we need a hook up here. It should have been up there. And that's where engines do engine work and trucks do truck work. So I could probably go on and on with this, but we'll just leave all this food for thought out there.
So Jerry, if I can get back to you, you're talking about that specific target hazard where you know that the water supply is only going to be able to fight a fire to a certain size fire. And that's what you're left with. So I'm sure all of us have been on fires that were losing battles where you knew you were going to have to be there for days. Eventually the incident commander turned it from some type of offensive use to let's just protect exposures and settle in. We're going to be here for multiple days. At what point of your plan do you have as an incident commander where you're thinking, when is enough? Like in that target hazard, what is the thing that's going to trigger the departments around you to say, okay, this is a loser. It's a loser plan. This is where we're going to go. And we're going to try and make the stop here rather than trying to stop it in the building. Is that too far into the weeds for pre-planning, or is that like a judgment call, situational type thing?
I think your point is really good, Jeff. I don't know what the answer is in my neck of the woods. It's probably going to be when we're overwhelmed and we're at the holy shit point is when we start backing up thinking defensive, or when we lose a fireman or something like that. I think the key here is that we know we have a lot of fire potential and we have a limited water potential. So I think our plan, I've been able to convince our leaders to develop a plan to use water from outside that water district. So the tank that supplies the area around this particular hazard, it's a heavy timber mill. The next municipal water available to us is a half a mile away. So a little, you know, pre-planning, a little fire prevention here. If we developed a plan to get that water a half a mile away into this fire, I think we'd be a whole lot better off. And it's great, like Jeff said, that, you know, we're all experts around a conference table, but if we pull an engine from here, an engine from there, do they have 4-inch? Do they have 5-inch? Do they have the fittings? It's the devil's in the details. Like Shoup was saying before that. So to answer your question, I don't know that the question is, when do we go defensive? I think the question is, how do we go defensive? And you better have that plan in place and you better have it tested, because in this case, there's mom and pop stores across the street. There's high density housing, 3-story wood frames on the other side. So wow. Jeff, like you said, the building collapses, you get a huge influx of firebrands, serious size firebrands dropping down on this housing area. You got high exposure or high radiant heat lighting up the other side of the street. And guess what? We don't have enough water for the fire. Now we don't have enough water for 3 fires. So the plan better be, you better have a plan on how to, and you better have exercised that plan to get that big water in quickly, because you're losing not only the fire building, but you're losing 2 exposures at least.
Yeah. The conflagration, whether it's in a commercial complex or residential, I mean, it's I think most firemen go to one of those, at least one of those in their career. And it's, it puts it into you like, wow. I mean, you think going to your house fires or your little apartment fires that, you know, you got this job figured out. Then you go to one of those big ones and you're like, man, I've been here for a couple of days now. This is not getting better.
That's right. We've lost the fire building. We lost the town. We lost the residences. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
just try to keep it in the same zip code.
Right. There you go.
Yeah. Hey, something else somebody mentioned just real quick was wind, and Shoop was talking about straight stream versus, you know, or combination nozzles versus solid bores. We talk master streams. The wind plays hell with these. I know everybody knows that, but it's just, again, something else to think about. You're shooting that master stream up into the wind, and wind's just going, you know, and your master stream isn't even getting water in the fire anymore.
So at that point, like, you got to be able to look at that, admit that it's not working, and then try to reposition. Those outriggers move both in and out, right?
Yeah. Move it. Theoretically.
Yeah. Again, you know, we saw changes in the American Fire Service starting in the 70s, and I can recall anyhow. I mean, there's always been changes in this firefighting profession, but when I came in and I was wondering, why are we doing this? Why are we getting rid of that? So forth. For example, you know, we used to have our own fuel truck, you know, major fires. That fuel truck would go out and, you know, fill up everybody's fuel tank because you're pumping a long time. As you say, this is going to be a fire that we're going to be at for a long time. So that was the reason for having one of those. But fire departments, and Chicago still got them. And I know New York has, what was the old Maxi water system, Jerry? You know, they still got that Maxi water?
Rapid water.
Not rapid water. The Maxi.
Oh, like the super pumpers and that kind of stuff.
Yes, yeah. Right. They got something where they designed all these special pumpers and so forth, and hose wagons. Yep. We got rid of the hose wagons, and many departments did, because someone was going around saying, oh, well, you know, you got to be progressive. You got to be, you know, getting away from that old traditional stuff. No, that stuff is still necessary today, because it's, I forget who said it, it was the built environment that we've created, that these fires, look at Chad. Chad's prime example, you know, of, you're building 4 and 5 story residential structures out of wood frame. And we're seeing it everywhere, even the older cities. You got the concrete platform, and then you got the wood framing on those several stories above it. You're not going to handle those with a hand line. So you need to have those deluge trucks, I call them, with the large diameter hose. You know, if you got a water, a river, major lake, or a big lake or something like that, where you can have a fire boat or something hook in, and you have these trucks with all that hose. San Francisco's got them. They got them for earthquake potential too. And they got cisterns in the streets and so forth. And you lay out and you tap off your engines, or you get that big gun going, you know. And it's not a regular 1,000-gallon-a-minute master stream. We're talking, like we were talking before we started the show here, about 2.25, 2.5-inch tips. You're throwing 2,500 gallons a minute, because you need to in those fire situations. But we listen to people who says, oh, I'll get rid of that, we don't need that anymore, and things like that. It's like, no, we hurt ourselves after these fires, you know, and overpower them.
So the initials, I've come up with initials for that progressive movement. It's called DOA, Destroyers of America. And it's like destroyers of the fire service. You know, that when you say progressive, it's, I'm not sure. It's
more regressive, isn't it? And Soup, I guess we're shit out of luck on the rivers.
Okay.
You're not going to have a fire boat. We might be able to get a fire Sea-Doo.
Well, those of us that do have that river or that lake or whatever,
or both.
Well, all right, I think this is a pretty good we're at just about an hour, covered quite a bit here on the master streams. You guys want to go around real quick, any other either experience-based observations or something you want to add here before we kind of sum it up? John, you got anything?
No, I'd just say to the officers out there and the firemen, you know, pay attention to your district, train on it, be prepared for that fire. Don't know when or if it's ever going to come, but be ready for it either way.
Yeah, I'll kind of echo John. You know, when I started using that RAM, the guys had never done it. So we went out and we practiced on it for a couple of weeks, and I made sure everybody knew how to do it and could do it by themselves. You know, like you said, train on the, when you see the fire is not the first time to try it.
For sure. Yeah. Big problems with that. Jerry or Jeff?
Yeah, I just got one thing quick. We all kind of think of master streams going this direction. I've seen them used very successfully in this direction. You know, the tip out of a tower ladder bucket or even an aerial that's low and into the strip mall or that kind of thing. And it's kind of flexible, so you get some movement with it. The water that's coming down this way, and you all talked about it, it doesn't really necessarily get to a lot of what's burning. So when we see that aerial ladder up here, what happens? It operates for a couple hours until what? Until the roof completely burns off, because that water is not getting onto the underside of the surface. So we think about master streams, using it that way isn't a bad idea either.
There you go. Hey, Jeff.
Okay, getting apparatus, especially your engines, in position, your first arriving engines. I won't say the first due, but I'll say the first arriving engines. When you're arriving and you've got that big ball of fire and you know you're going to have engines requiring a lot of water coming in, subsequent arriving engines, and the old guys used to be so good with this. You know, here you got to, you know, again, young kids, you know, are ready to pull a line. They want to go inside. We're going to take a line in here. You got five stories of fire. It's like, are we out of our minds? No. Bosses, keep your young people under control. Make them learn, as you guys were saying. But to see subsequent arriving engines coming in, and instead of driving in, nose into the fire, the old guys would stop and back that engine in. And the intent was those engines already on the scene are going to need to augment their water supply. So you could drop a supply line into their intake, send that engine out to another hydrant on another main or something like that, so they could guarantee that heavy volume of water for that situation. So.
Yeah, planning for that water supply need is huge on these big fires. It's definitely the deal breaker.
Okay.
Gotta get the water in. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Try to catch us at the strategicfiretraining.com. You can get us on the Gmail and on the Facebook. We want to thank everybody for hosting us, coming out and doing some hands-on training with you, and also stopping in virtually like this. It's good to share what we have with others and keep the tradition alive. So
thank you to Washington, and look forward to seeing Waco next week.
Yeah, Waco, Texas, here we come. Looking forward to it. All right, guys.
Yeah, if anybody has any interest in doing any training with us, by all means, get a hold of us. You know, we're all available.
Surprisingly affordable.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. That's it. Have a good night.